I think we'll go ahead and get started, and I just wanted to remind you, it's pledge week. If you haven't made your pledge to NPR, be sure to do that. You can go online, except not here. Well, I guess you can now.
I thought you were going to say pledge week at Holton.
Oh, well, it is that too. It's always pledge week at Holton. I don't know if some of you might have been here last night, so if there's a repeat, I hope I tell the same truth as last night. Before we, I'll just introduce myself briefly. I'm Werner Jansen, and I actually grew up in Nebraska. My father was pastor in Nebraska in the old central district of the American Lutheran Church for many years, and then I ended up going to Wartburg College in Waverly, Iowa for a couple of years, and then transferred to Purdue University and graduated in aeronautical engineering, and came out to the Northwest with Boeing. And it was while I was with Boeing that I heard about Holton Village and came up here in the end of September of 1961 when they were dedicating the diesel electric plants. That was the only power that Holton had at that time. When the mine closed down, they took down the distribution stations up the mine that provided the power for the mine and the community. And so when Holton started, there was no electricity up here, and they brought up the diesel electric generators, which actually came from a small remote fishing village in Alaska. And one of the fellows that was involved in the early days of Holton was a part of NC Machinery in Seattle that, you know, sells the Caterpillar equipment and so forth. And he arranged or found out about these diesel units that were rebuilt after coming down from Alaska, and they shipped them up here. And they were 250 kilowatt units. And in those early days, the diesel fuel was 17 cents a gallon, and we couldn't afford to run them 24 hours a day. So if some of you were up here in those early days, we always turned the generators off at 10 p.m. So after 10 p.m., the village was completely dark, and that's when all the good parties and conversations started. And it was interesting when we finally, the hydro units were started construction in 1963, and we got the units in operation with the lower diversion dam in August of 1964. So, you know, theoretically we had power 24 hours a day, but the community voted to turn it off at 10 o'clock at night because that was tradition. And once people start a tradition, they don't want to change very easily. but we weren't able to do that because our insurance company at the time, you know, said that they were tolerant about our turning off the electricity at 10 because it was diesel and it was expensive and so forth. But they said when we got the hydro plant and we had the capabilities of having 24-hour power, that they requested or demanded that if they continue to insure us, then we had to have the power on 24 hours a day. So there was some conversation in the village and a request that we have emergency lighting and refrigeration kept on electricity, but all the lights turned off. I mean, there were people that tried everything to make sure that we could go back to the delight of having complete darkness, you know, at 10 o'clock at night. So, but that was just early times at Holton Village. I'm sharing things with you on the basis of my experience up here. I really came to the village the first time in 1961 when they dedicated the diesel units. And if some of you are from the Seattle area, you probably recognize the name of Stan Borison. He was an entertainer, a Norwegian entertainer on King TV, and he also was a Lutheran, or is a Lutheran, he's still living. So he came up as the entertainment for the weekend, and there were 32 people that came up that weekend for the dedication. Pastor, can't remember his first name, Brown from Finney Ridge Lutheran, was the pastor that was here to provide the official dedication ceremonies. You know, you always have to have a religious ceremony anytime you dedicate diesel plants, so. And, I don't think we ever, I guess maybe we did dedicate the hydro plants at one time. But anyway, that was my first experience, and during the time there were some people from some of the committees in Seattle that were working on Boulder, and they requested volunteers to serve on committees. And in those years, the committees were made up of anybody who was willing to sit in on meetings. And I was single at the time, and I was working at Boeing, and I had extra time, so I volunteered for all the committees that were had any space. So I ended up getting in on a lot of conversations, and you know, working with Gil Berg, and even I thought one of the interesting things, and if some of you are old timers from Seattle, you might recognize the name of Vic Nelson. He was a furrier in Seattle. He was was a well known furrier right across from the old Frederick and Nelson's, and he was on the development council. I could never figure out why a furrier would be involved in it. But he was a willing participant that was willing to put a little money and time in the operation. And so, you know, again, in those early years, just about all the activities for Holden were in Seattle. You know, after Wes got the letters from House Sound, he had to find a organization that was financially responsible. That was part of what the Forest Service demanded, that West just couldn't accept the gift and start an organization. The Forest Service said, since this is on Forest Service property, Holden Village proper, they said that you have to have an organization that was financially responsible, so that they knew that something was going to happen here. And so that's why LBI got involved, and that was the only reason LBI got involved. And but LBI held the ownership of Holden Village until Holden Village Incorporated was started, a nonprofit corporation in the state of Washington, that really is independent of the Lutheran Church. And at least all the time that I was here, that's what we always told people, is that Holden Village was a nonprofit corporation that was associated with the Lutheran Church, but it wasn't owned by the Lutheran Church. It was obviously strongly Lutheran, because everybody associated was Lutheran, and the pastors that came here were Lutheran, the hymnals we got were Lutheran, and the theology by and large was Lutheran. But even the theology, I didn't go to, well, I did go to seminary for one quarter, I think, but the theology of Holden, as you probably have seen or known over the years, sort of changes. I mean, it's good theology, but that doesn't mean that, there's a little leeway, always. when Holden started, there was, I mentioned last night, there was no business plan, because if there would have been a business plan by competent accountants and business people, they would have said, don't even think about starting Holden. And the same way with program, there was no program plan. Really, like Gil Berg and Vic Nelson and some of these people from Seattle, most of them were from the Lutheran Free Church, which merged into the old American Lutheran Church, I think. And these were the people that came up, looked at it, saw a vision, had an excitement for the place, even though it might have looked impossible to some people, but to them it didn't, And I don't think in all the meetings I attended in those early years, there was really not much of a discussion of program. It was, I think in their minds, it was, it'll develop into an adult Bible camp. And because everybody was familiar, the Bible camp movement in those years was very strong. And I think that's one reason why Holden Village succeeded, is that there were, people, young people and young married people that had come up through the Bible camp experience and had a wonderful experience, and there was nothing for them to do anymore except go to church. Holden Village, in a sense, provided a sort of an adult religious experience that had a little leeway in the thinking. And, you know, that's some of what I want to communicate, you know, in this session, is just the uniqueness of you know, being tied in a sense to the Lutheran Church and to the Church in general. But what happened up here, at least from my perspective, again, I'm not a theologian, my training is aeronautical engineering, which I was only in for 2 or 3 years, and then I started as manager of Holden. And so, I mean, I'm giving you a perspective as I saw it. And I'm not saying totally it was true, but, you know, if nobody counters it. And if you do, tell me afterwards. Don't interrupt me. But the three Lutheran youth bodies, you know, at that time it was the American Lutheran Church, the Missouri Synod, and the LCA, I think, at the time that we started. The Augustana Synod had merged into the LCA. I can't remember what else merged, but they merged into the LCA. And Bergstrand, Dr. Wilton Bergstrand, was the youth director of the Augustana Lutheran Church for many years, as I understand it. And at the merger, then he, in a sense, was without a job. And so he got involved in Holden, and the first offer for directorship of Holden was to Wilton Bergstrand, and he was here a number of summers as sort of the, you know, the pastor in residence and the Bible study leader and de facto director, I guess, although he didn't have any administrative duties at that point. And the board of Holden at that time, which again was primarily Seattle people with a smattering of people from the youth offices from the Bible East and Midwest. And so they offered the job to Wilton Bergstrand, and he couldn't make up his mind, I guess, if he wanted to, or if he maybe didn't think that Holden could make it. And he held the call for, I think, over a year, and finally the board of Holden decided, well, you know, after a year, if you haven't made up your mind, then, you know, maybe we need to look elsewhere. And that's when I think Carol Henderly had been teaching some courses at Luther Seminary, but wasn't on the faculty. Many of you, you know Carol. He was a very unique, wonderful, both individual and theologian and youth leader. But he was also somewhat erratic and emotional. And Dr. Al Rodness was the president of Luther Seminary at the time, and he was up here quite a number of times, and he told me lots of stories about Carol and Mary. And Mary's father was Dr. Osgar, who was the bishop of the old Norwegian Lutheran Church, I think it was. So, I mean, there was a lot of history involved in all of that. But Dr. Rodgers told me that, you know, we don't know what to do with Carol. You know, we invited him, because after the youth, when he left the youth office and when it merged into, I guess it was the, I don't know, ELC or ELCA, I can't remember, there's been so many mergers, whatever it is. That then Carol was without a job, and Al Rodness invited him over to the seminary, but never with the idea that he would be a full-time professor. And then Holden Village came along, and so it was a marvelous thing, and again, either divine intervention or luck, depends on what you believe in, that Carol then became involved in Holden. But, you know, he had no experience at running a retreat center or any activity like this. And he used to joke with people as he went around the country telling them, Holden, that, you know, this was a very strange operation, because, you know, God provided Holden Village to the church, and then he called a defunct youth minister that was sort of ostracized by the church, and he called an aeronautical engineer, and you know, to run this place. And you know, it was true. And I mentioned last night that, you know, it didn't make any sense to start Holden Village, but you know, we didn't know that, and we just had a lot of enthusiasm and loved the mountains, or at least I did. And so Holden, you know, got started, and we just went from, in a sense, literally from day to day. But, you know, and nobody in the church really knew what to do with it as far as programming. The youth offices of the three major bodies were officially on the board. That was the first time that Eleanor Whip got on the board, and I can't remember who the other youth offices were at that time, but they were on the board, and then they also were responsible for programming when it really started. And their hope was that Holden could be a young adult ministry, because what they were seeing in the church at the time is that after Bible camp and after, you know, kids got to be 18 and didn't mind their parents anymore, they dropped out of church or they, you know, went off to, you know, some strange attitude of what the world was all about, and the church had no control over them anymore. So the youth offices were really looking for something to recapture the young adults. You know, they figured that from 18 until the time they got married was the dangerous time. And if Holden could solve the problem of the dangerous time, then once they got married, then they would go back into the church and they would be, you know, good members again. The youth offices came up with a program the first year, and they called it the Young Adults Tahican, because Tahican is the Indian word, at least, but this is what everybody says, the way through. And so it sounded like a good thing for the program to be named as Tahican, and the way through for the young adults to, you know, go beyond youth and get into something serious when you're supposed to get married and rejoin the church. And it was really a failure. The program was a total failure. We did have a lot of people coming out, and it was. Was anybody here during that time? So I don't think. I think most of the ones that I remember came were the young adults who couldn't find a mate, and were hoping that they would come out here and find a mate. And that's okay. I mean, I had problems finding a mate too. And so I understand the situation. But anyway, at sort of at the end of that summer, then it was obvious that the youth offices didn't really. I mean, they weren't here. They were back in Minneapolis and St. Louis and Philadelphia. And they weren't thinking about holding on a year-round basis. They really weren't providing any support. In the early years, there was an agreement that I think the ALC provided $10,000 a year, the LCA was $7,500, and the Missouri Synod contributed $3,500. So we got whatever that was. I can't add that quickly. But anyway, that was the total amount that we got from the church bodies. And I remember one time that Carol came into, you know, our offices, Carol and my offices were up where the registration office is now. There were two separate offices. It used to be the apartment up there for the operator of the hotel during the mining years, and it was divided into two rooms and actually had a little kitchen and, of course, the bathroom, which doesn't lend into the story at all, but he came into the office, and he was really upset. He held a letter in his hand. He said, I got a letter from the ALC, and they're dropping support for us because, did anybody work for One Magazine? maybe you don't remember it, but it was the Young Adult Magazine. And of course, like most of the periodicals, it was losing money. And there was, you know, decision that they would put the money into One Magazine rather than, you know, trying to help Holden get going. And Carol was, I mean, he was livid. I mean, I'm sure he wrote a letter to somebody back there and maybe he burned it, I don't know. But when Carol was upset, he could write some pretty effective letters. Anyway, that was sort of the end of the contributions that the church bodies made to Holden Village. After that, we were completely on our own, and we basically started with no bank account. Again, I mentioned last night that if it wasn't for the World's Fair in Seattle in 1962, you know, we may not have survived, because that brought out a lot of Lutherans from the Midwest that were looking for a new experience, and some of the church periodicals the year before had encouraged them to stop off here on their way to Seattle to the World's Fair. So, you know, all of those things, it was sort of a different time in the church, and a time when, you know, all these things happened that I think allowed Holden to get started that otherwise, just wouldn't have happened. And the Lutheran youth offices were also supposed to be responsible for the volunteer staff. And the idea was that Holden would have the core staff of like 10, 8 or 10 people. And then the youth offices would choose 30 young adults from the United States to come out for, the months of June, July, and August. And the only problem is that they didn't do that. And so, the one summer when that was supposed to happen, we had the core staff of 10 here, but, we didn't get all that we needed, that we felt we needed from the church body. So at the end of that year, I told Carol, I said, this isn't going to work. Let's, thank them for, their interest, and let's do it ourselves. So after that point, I think it was probably in the, 1965, maybe 65, I think, that I took over as staff coordinator then, and then all of the, publicity for the staff and the applications and everything went out of Holden Village. And, it was a time in history when volunteerism was possible and was more socially available. The college wasn't as expensive. I don't know all the reasons, but it was, volunteerism was, very possible. And we, in those early years from probably 1965, 66 to, the mid-70s, we often got three, four times as many applications as we could use for volunteers. The word finally got around, and, primarily, St. Olaf, Augustana, all the other colleges, the Stanas and the whatever they, the word got around, and when somebody had a good experience and went back and was there the next year at college, then they told other people about it. So it really built up, and we had a lot of applications, and we could use, if I remember right, we actually could use about 100. No, I think about 200 applications a year, because we had the rule of 3 weeks as minimum, and there was no maximum in a sense at that point. At first, we weren't open in the wintertime, and so it was great. It was easy to come up with a staff, of people, and in fact, then people liked it and they wanted to come back a second year. And after a year of that, we discovered that wasn't going to work, because the second year people wanted to run Holden Village just the same way as they had the year before, which didn't make it as interesting, because, they remembered their high points and they wanted, the same things to happen. So we put in a unofficial rule. I'm sure the board didn't ever rule on it, but that people couldn't come back 2 years in a row. And we had enough applications, we could do it at that time. Now, later on in the late 70s, that wasn't possible. The number of volunteers, dropped off considerably. And again, we were able to develop a lot of retired people coming up to Holden as volunteers. And that was really a beautiful thing, because we used to say we had the brains of the retired people and the brawn of the young people to provide the operational activities of the village, and it worked out very well. And the thing that I was, thinking back after a couple of years of that the youth offices thought that Holden was a failure as far as the young adult ministry, and yet they missed the point that the volunteer staff was probably the greatest program of young adult ministry that's ever taken place in the United States. I mean, they didn't see that. The number of young adults, and I'm sure that some of you either were here as young adults or came, and it was a life-changing experience. They people would come here, they would get a chance to mingle with other people that were also struggling with ideas. They would had an excellent faculty to, you know, listen to and to argue with. And, you know, their parents weren't here, so if they said something wrong, they didn't get chastised or, you know, cut off. And so literally, the village became an arena for, I think, a lot of the young adults that, you know, in the 60s and early 70s was a different time for young people in the country. You know, colleges were being, administration buildings were being taken over and closed down, and you know, there was all kinds of tumult in the young adult community. And yet Holden was a place where they could come and they could be exposed to, you know, in a sense, all the disciplines of any college or university. We had, you know, Carol developed the program of science and technology and Bible and theology and art and music and all of these things. It was just like a mini college without a test. And so some young people, you know, decided all of a sudden that, you know, wow, education and learning was exciting. You know, and they saw professors that were excited with what they were saying, and they had conviction with what they were saying, and they could communicate. And so, you know, lives were literally changed. And this was an exciting part of the how Holden got started, and I think the reason that exceeded. And Carol had this vision of programming to a great extent, as I observed, because he had been in Europe after the war and had been a part of some of the young adult conferences or spiritual retreats that they had in Europe after the war. And I think it was an idea to, you know, within the church, Lutheran church and other churches in Europe, to try to get youth again to re-enter society and, you know, have some positive attitudes towards the future. And Carol was involved in some of those and I don't know if it was officially through the church or how he got involved in that, but coming back from that, then he, I think, saw that as the type of program that could take place at Holden and really what got it started. And again, when Holden started there, we had no reputation. It was, nobody knew what Holden was. A lot of the professors, you know, didn't want to take a chance on coming out here because, why volunteer for 3 weeks or more to come to a place that may be radical or, you know, not be accepted by the church? Or, you know, they were concerned with their own future, and if their boss found out that they were at Holden, maybe they wouldn't get tenure. I don't know. You know, I'm not sure what took place, but that was the case, and it was only because Carol had a lot of contacts in the church and knew people like Fritz Norstedt and Howard Hong and some of these people, and could get those people to come out here because of friendship and maybe coercion. And then once they came, because they were reputable people in the church, well then, you know, others were willing to come. And pretty soon, you know, the attitude, you know, of Holden, you know, was changed and became a place where you wanted to come as a professor or as a teacher. And so it changed completely that way. One of the, I thought, interesting things was Carol was interested in getting Wartburg Seminary more involved, because his tradition was Norwegian and Luther Seminary, and so a lot of the people that originally came were St. Olaf and Luther Seminary. So Dr. Ewald was the president of Wartburg Seminary at the time, and he found out that Dr. Ewald was an amateur potter. And so that he went to Dr. Ewald, he said, will you come out? And I don't remember if he ever had session, but I know that he set up the pottery shop. And Carol came to me and said that, we've invited Dr. Ewald out, and he expects that we'll have a pottery shop here. And that's the reason he's coming. So we started a pottery shop for Dr. Ewald. And that was how he came out here. But it also then started the pottery shop, which, you know, is famous, you know, over the years. And I don't know if any still exist. I know I found one at our house in one of the boxes that Dr. Ewald did, the plaque of Holden, the early plaque that was on that was used for a lot of promotion material. And he made molds and duplicated that and, you know, in ceramic and then mounted it on weathered wood. They were really beautiful and sold them in the store. And he did, you know, mugs with Holden insignias and so forth on it. And so it was a great experience. But I mean, you know, again, I'm sure some people think that the pottery shop started because we had the vision of that it was mentioned in the Bible and we should start this. It wasn't. It was to get Dr. Ewald out. But it evolved into, you know, a great thing. The other great thing that Carol brought to the, you know, Carol had flaws, but he was a great person, and it was, you know, because of him, I think, that the whole program really got started. And of course, his wife Mary, by some accounts, not mine, but again, I think it was Al Rogers from the seminary told me one time, he said, you know, Mary Hinderly is a much better theologian than Carol ever was. At that time, women, you know, had to be in the background. And I know that Mary had a great influence on Carol, but it was generally in the background, although later on she had her own sessions and, you know, she got involved in discussions, and it was obvious what a sharp woman she was. And but Al Rogers said, you know, people in the church really recognized Mary Hinderly as a much better theologian than Carol, although Carol was a good theologian in his own right, but, you know, Mary was a unique individual. And but the one thing that Carol did, and I thought it was a great thing, is that he always demanded that there both sides of an issue were presented in the village. And I guess as a teacher, or maybe even just as a person and theologian, that it really bothered him if only one side of an issue. So no matter if it was science, technology, theology, whatever it was, especially, you know, in the Bible study and theology, he would try to have faculty members here that maybe would have counter or views that weren't exactly the same. So it gave people listening to him the opportunity to hear different approaches and then, you know, discuss it. And then they themselves would make up their mind, you know, what they thought about it. And that was a big thing for Carol. And once in a while, when Carol, or when there would be somebody in the village that there was no counter faculty person available at that point, Carol would sit up in the balcony and listening to the lecture, and, you know, the lecturer would say something, and Carol would yell off the balcony, "But that's only one side of the story. Now the other side, you know," and he was smart enough that he would take the counter side, no matter what his own convictions were. He would say, "Well, you've got to consider this, and no, that's not right," or, you know, and so it created a situation in the village where, in a very real sense, it was a time when Holden, I think, had an impact on the church, not just the Lutheran church, but we had many people from other denominations, where lay people became theologians, and probably really Holden helped to bring about the priesthood of all believers, more so than the headquarters in Minneapolis, St. Louis, and Philadelphia at that time. And we had pastors that would, you know, and I think they were partially joking, but also truthful, that they would either write us, or when they were up here, they would tell us, you know, Holden is really making their life more difficult. Because, you know, earlier, pre-Holden, that it was only the pastor that was reading theological books or books that were, you know, talking about certain subjects. And then the pastor would tell the congregation, you know, the right way. I'm sorry if I'm offending anybody, but I have the right to do that. and it was a real thing, and things started to change in the church, where all of a sudden laymen were coming back from Holden and were entering into discussion with the pastor and saying, "Well, you know, have you thought about this? Or, you know, maybe we should, why don't you read this book? Because this book explains it a little bit different." And I remember a lot of young adults that came up to Holden, you know, would talk to me and say, well, I, out of this experience, you know, I decided to think about the ministry, and I'd say, big mistake. I told them, you know, one of the problems is that just because you now maybe understand your relationship with God better, that doesn't mean you have to be a minister. You can be an engineer or a nurse or a doctor and, you know, be a theologian. And you're more effective in the church that way than a lot of pastors can be. And so I was talking people out of going into the ministry. I don't know if it ever worked, but it bothered me because, I mean, I went through the same thing, that my father was a pastor and his father was a pastor and my mother married a pastor and all of her brothers were pastors. My mother's side of the family was Strang. So if you, with Wartburg College or Wartburg Seminary, Bill Strang was the longtime professor at Wartburg Seminary. And down at the Texas Lutheran College, my uncle A.L. Strang was a longtime professor down there. So, I mean, you know, I came from a long line of of clergy. And I think from the time I was old enough, I sort of assumed my father was going to force me into the ministry, and he never did. I don't think we ever had a discussion where, you know, he said that, you know, I'm really hoping you'll go into the ministry or anything. I mean, it was always my decision. My brother became a psychiatrist, and I think it was because of some of the problems I was having. Both of us, I went into engineering, and we didn't feel any, you know, pressure in the sense of going into the, you know, into a ministry into the church. But I think that's one reason that I may have ended up here at Holden, because I still felt guilty. And I had a good job of going and really enjoyed it. But when this came up, I loved the mountains, but maybe it was also that now I could be involved in something with the church and I wouldn't have to feel guilty anymore. So it's... But that's it. I think that Holden had an impact on a lot of laymen in the church, and I think that, you know, things started changing. And it was also in a period of the history of Lutheranism at that time. You know, the Missouri Synod was going through some real conflicts, and Seminex was started, which was a counter group to the original Missouri Synod. I don't know all the terminology or history, but some of the teachers and professors at the Missouri Synod Seminary in St. Louis broke away and started Seminex. And Walt Bowman, I think, was one of these. Paul Hain was sort of involved in that. I don't think he taught at the seminary, but he was involved in that. Rich Kamer's father was a famous teacher at the seminary, and he broke away. And it was a very hard time because these people had a love for their church, but they also felt that the church was, going in the wrong direction or not allowing, you know, thought to take place. And so they basically left the church because they needed some freedom. Well, Holden, you know, was here at the time. So Holden became basically a haven, I think, for, you know, some of these people that were really searching and looking for an opportunity to, you know, struggle through their own thoughts, which was very difficult for them. And Holden became a home. And so, in a very real sense, that through a lot of the discussion, that Holden was sort of a home place that they would come and have discussions with others, get rejuvenated, and then they would go back and try to, you know, work on, you know, outside of Holden's arena. And even some of the national conventions that were taking place at that time, that people would go from here to the national conventions and would, you know, speak eloquently about, you know, that things have to change. And so I think Holden provided, you know, an arena for them that allowed them to do something within the church that may not have happened if Holden hadn't been here. And this also happened for a lot of youth. In fact, one of the interesting things was that, as you remember, that you know, Lutherans weren't able to commune together for many years in the, I don't know, 50s, 60s, especially between the Missouri Synod and the others. And even when Holden got started, that was respected. But, you know, more and more people started thinking, well, this is crazy. You know, here we're gathered together as a community of believers, and yet, you know, we can't commune together. So I remember, I think it was on the 4th of July, I think we called it the, you know, the Independence Celebration. And Carol gathered, I know, myself, and I think it was Walt Bowman, and somebody was representing the LCA, Lazarus, Dr. Lazarus, I think was his name. He was a well-known theologian and was here at the village. And Carol said, we're going to go up behind Chalet 7, we're going to have a communion service, and we're going to end this separation. And so we went up behind the chalet. We had a communion service there of, you know, all three synods. And Carol says, from henceforth, that communion is going to be open in the village, and there's not going to be any celebration, and anyone who believes in Jesus Christ as their Lord and Savior, you know, can join in. And from then on, you know, and we were, I think, holding was the first place that might have done that. And nobody really paid any attention, except the people that were here. And in fact, when we started Fullness of God Lutheran Church, which was here, Dr. Solberg was the bishop of the ALC in Seattle at the time. And we decided it was very strange that we didn't have a congregation here, because even if we had communion here, you know, the church rules said that we had to report how many people communed. You know, they do that in congregations, I guess, still. And anyway, we had to report to Shalom Lutheran Church how many people communed on a particular Sunday. And so theoretically, we were a member of, I mean, I was actually a member of Lake Chelan Lutheran Church, but we would send down our reports, and Lake Chelan Lutheran Church, at least that time, you know, had 40 members. And we would have 400 people in there, you know, in the village. We'd send down a report that, you know, 440 people communed on a particular Sunday. And finally, I think even the church bodies got word that this was silly. And we talked to Dr. Solberg and said, well, can't we start a congregation up here at Holden? And he came up here and met with us, and, you know, there was really no reason why we couldn't. We had to have a pastor. Well, officially we called Carol as our pastor. I think I was president of the congregation. And, you know, you know, we decided that all of the contributions or all the offerings of Holden, of the Fullness of God Lutheran Church, would go to... you know, away from Holden. It wouldn't stay here. I mean, the congregation had no expenses. Holden was paying Carol as the director. We didn't have a building. We didn't have any robes to buy. And so, you know, 100% of the offerings, you know, went out to, you know, various charities in Wenatchee and, you know, in the church-wide and so forth. And so it was a rather unique congregation. And, of course, it changed over the years. And finally... it was decided that maybe Carol shouldn't be both pastor and director, and that's when the whole idea of a village pastor was created. And since that time, then, you know, instead of the director of the village being also the pastor of Holden Scott, Holden had a village pastor that was pastor of Fullness of God congregation. But during the winter, you know, Carol wasn't here all the time that he was director. He was only at the village, you know, 4 or 5 months a year, and I was the only other administrative person, you know, in the village. So in the early years, you know, once Carol left, I mean, it didn't officially take place, but then I was responsible for worship. I was responsible for program, whatever program we had, you know, we came up with in the village. And at first, I didn't know whether we should have communion or not, and I decided, well, you know, we have no communication. And, you know, unless somebody reports us, we can't get into trouble, so. This is very emotional. Anyway, somebody did report us. And one time, Dr. Solberg was up here, and he asked to meet with Carol and myself and said, you know, this really isn't proper because Werner isn't an ordained pastor, and so he shouldn't really be, you know, in charge of communion. And Carol said, well, what are our options? You know, should we not have service? And Dr. Solberg said, well, no, I'm just telling you it's not proper. I'm not telling you you can't do it. I gained a new appreciation for the bishop at that time because he was true to the church, but he also recognized that times were a-changing. And even after I retired from here, you know, Fritz Norstedt, who was interim director of Holden for a year, retired in Leavenworth, and I was in Leavenworth, and I worked with Carl Florey, who was a pastor at Faith Lutheran, which is a very small Lutheran church in Leavenworth, and Carl was, he didn't like any administrative work of the church. He wanted to preach and teach, and he was going to leave, and I told him, you can't leave, you're too valuable, you know. And I didn't have any employment at the time, and I said, well, I'll be the administrator of the church, and then you do the preaching and teaching. So Carl and I had a joint ministry, unofficially, I guess, that we worked together. And then Carl finally did leave and started the community covered in Leavenworth and that whole area. And so Faith Lutheran was without a pastor, and Fritz Norstedt said, well, you know, why don't we have a lay pastor? And, you know, Fritz and I were well acquainted. And it was only because of Fritz, I'm sure the congregation wouldn't have voted me in as the lay pastor. But for a year and a half, then I was the lay pastor of Faith Lutheran. And the bishop, you know, provided the cover or the permission for me to, you know, officiate. The only thing I couldn't do was marry people. And but I was involved in everything else. But I guess the point is that Holden did, you know, start, I think, the church. No, I mean, it wasn't just Holden, but Holden was one of the many things, I think, at that time that started the church thinking in a different way and looking at some of the rules that, you know, may still be on the books, but, you know, it's more important to, you know, be compassionate with people. It's more important to work with people. It's more important to help people. It's more important to love people than it is to follow rules. And I think that that's what Holden, in a real sense, you know, helped do. Because, Holden was separate enough from the world in a real sense that we could do things up here. And, you know, once we had the communion service back of Chalet 7, you know, there was no bolt of lightning that came down. Nobody was punished. And so, you know, it was like, whoa, we can do that, so maybe we can think about something else. And when Fullness of God Lutheran Church was started up here, there was a movement, and I don't know exactly when it started, but I think it was called Reconciled in Christ. I think that was what it was called, that opened, you know, encouraged conversation, our congregation to be open to gay, lesbian members and fellowship. And so Fullness of God Lutheran Church was the first church to become a Reconciled in Christ church. And it so happened that Faith Lutheran Church in Leavenworth was the second congregation that became a Reconciled in Christ church. And I think for many years it was just Holden and Faith Lutheran that were the only ones that were listed as Reconciled in Christ. And I think even now there aren't that many, but of course times are changing and you know, you don't have to be reconciled in Christ to be open to gay and lesbian members and fellowship. So, you know, again, that Holden, those early days of Holden were in a, you know, a real transitional time of the church and the program. And so I think it was exciting, you know, for people to come up here and be exposed to what was here. And even the bookstore played a big part in it. You know, Mary Hinderly was, of course, a big reader, and Lola Dean, who is on the board and is meeting with the board, she had, as a result of her experience here at Holden, her husband was a pediatrician on Mercer Lake in outside of Seattle. in Mercer Island. I mean, Mercer Island, not Mercer Lake. And anyway, she got this idea of starting a bookstore on Mercer Island that would, you know, have a great variety of books, not just, you know, certain books for the rich people on Mercer Island, but for maybe even some theological books. And so she actually started a very successful bookstore there. And Bev and Dave Larson, who were also very much involved in Holden Village in the early days, he was an accountant and then a land baron. I guess not really. he came up to me and says, "I'm going to give you a check for $1,000 if you'll buy books for the bookstore and promise to invest all the income into more books, so that, you know, Holden could build up a bookstore that really would provide, you know, some significant books for people to read." And the reason that he did that, he says, "You know, I don't get a lot of chance to read books. If I come up here for a week, I want to go to the bookstore and be able to buy a book that, you know, will really be meaningful to me." And he said, you know, at that point, we still didn't have, you know, a lot of variety in the bookstore. So Lola Dean and Mary then were given the charge of, you know, starting to, you know, make the bookstore here at Holden a really unique and significant part of the whole experience of Holden, which it has been, and I'm sure has continued. But those were, you know, some of the things, again, that, you know, nobody in the beginning said that Holden was going to have a bookstore and it was going to be significant. We just said, well, I mean, at first the only books that we offered there were the books that the faculty wanted to read or they were, you know, using for their reference, and that's what we had in the bookstore, and we didn't really go beyond that. I mean, the sideline of it was that that it became the bookstore and the store became very lucrative. I think even in 1983 when I left here, the bookstore was, and the general store was making over $100,000, you know, for the village. And that money had even been more we were making than off of guests. Because the guests didn't pay for their, they only paid for about half of their time up here, but the bookstore brought in some pretty good income. So, you know, a lot of these things that happened up here were, you know, somebody like Lola Dean coming and saying, you know, we need to improve the bookstore, you know. And it wasn't Carol or myself that, you know, had this grand idea that the bookstore was going to be a, you know, significant part of Holden. Got to look at my notes so I don't get too far off. But in the wintertime, as I said, that Carol was only here for, you know, for five months at the very most. And the first few winters, we just had a very minimum amount of programming. And, you know, some of this was even, you know, we would use recordings from the summer. If there was, you know, a lecture, we would replay some of these and use them to stimulate our discussion. And as far as worship, we carried on the worship life of the village just like it is now. I mean, you know, I was doing most of the preaching of the Sunday services, which, you know, wasn't necessary, but that's, I guess, how it happened. But one of the fun things was that, again, if you're from the Seattle area, St. Mark's Cathedral, which is the Episcopalian cathedral in Seattle, has a wonderful compline service on Sunday evenings. And I know when I got there in Seattle that I had heard about it, and they called it the skier service. Because in the wintertime, you know, all the young adults headed up to the ski areas during, you know, Sunday and weren't there for the Sunday service, but the evening compline was the time when, you know, the skiers would arrive back in Seattle still in their ski clothes and would go to the compline service. And it was beautiful. I mean, the very professional singing of the compline choir that they had developed there, and it became, I think, really a national recognition for St. Mark's. But I had heard on, at that time, King FM, which was a radio station that was primarily a classical music station in Seattle. On Sunday nights, they broadcast live the compline service from St. Mark's. And so I wrote to King FM and I said, you know, is there any way that you can make a tape of that and send it up here, and so that we can use it as part of our worship service on Wednesday night? Because They did it on Sunday night. They would put it in the mail on Monday, and there was no vote on Tuesday, so we did it on Wednesday. And they did that. They said, I thought it was sort of cheap of them, but they said, you know, you supply the tape, and you know, the cassette tape doesn't. And it so happened that after I retired here, that I started working with Harriet Bullitt, who was the owner of King Broadcasting. And I don't know if I ever told her that I thought it was cheap, but it was a nice connection. But we did that for that whole winter. That King FM sent us the combine service, and that was part of our winter schedule for 1 or 2 years, I don't recall. But it was, you know, and then a little bit later on, John Grover, who was the son-in-law of Carol, and his wife started, what was it called, Lifestyle Enrichment? Was that it? No. Yeah, Lifestyle Enrichment Program. And it was, again, sort of an intense living, studying, you know, primarily for young adults through the winter. And that was, you know, one of the first programming items that we had. And the other thing that happened was we started getting inquiries from teachers at some of the colleges and universities that they asked about having sabbatical experiences here at Holden, where they would come with their family for the whole winter and stay here. And, you know, so, you know, it was not only a little extra money because I can't remember if we charged, maybe we didn't even charge. But they provided the programming, and that was part of the, you know, the idea that they would come spend the winter here. But it also was complicated a little bit because, you know, the families came with children that needed to continue on in school, and at that point we didn't have a school here at Holden. Well, about the same time, a judge from Whitman County, which is over east of here, around Othello or someplace down there, Pullman, and he came up here, and you know he said that, you know, one of the things that he struggles with is that as a judge that he deals with a lot of delinquency problems. And he said, we have no place to send young boys to really gain, some healing. And he said, one of the problems is that all the group homes for boys are basically commercial installations. They take 20 to 30 boys because what the state provided for group home boys was not enough unless you had at least 20 students or 20 people. And you know, then it became an entirely different experience, and he talked to me and said that, you know, would there be any possibility that you might consider starting a group home with just 6 boys? And I said, well, I don't know, I'll talk to Carol. And, you know, so we talked about it and looked into it, and we decided to go ahead and try it, you know, and we did it just with, at that point, the state of Washington didn't have as strict a rules, and we also saw it as a possibility because if we started a group home, then we could have the, you know, like the schools get from USDA, the surplus food. And we thought maybe, especially in the wintertime, that would help our finances because based on 6 boys here, we could get surplus food. And that didn't really turn out too well, but it, you know, that was sort of a consideration. And one of the we assigned one of the fellows here to be the counselor of the group home. And the only thing with that was that we needed a school because the state said, well, you've got to educate the boys when they come to Holden. So I went down and talked to the superintendent of the school in Chelan and said, I'll make you a deal. And here's the deal you can't turn down. I said, we'll provide a teacher without cost to Chelan if you'll you know, provide accreditation for the boys that attend the school here. And, you know, Cease West was the superintendent of the school in Chelan, and he was also a member of the Little Lutheran Church there that had 440 people for communion. anyway, Cease, you know, was very anxious and to work with us on this. But the problem was, even though we were going to provide provide the teacher free of charge, the union, the teachers' union, wouldn't allow it. They said, well, if you're going to have an accredited school at Holden, then the teacher that is selected for Holden has to go through the same hiring process and be paid the same amount of money. And, you know, we didn't know that was going to work out. The thing was, in the state of Washington, they have what they call, maybe other states do too, they call remote necessary schools. And Stehekin is one of these. And even Leavenworth was one for a while. But Holden definitely, you know, qualified for that. And this meant that if we had a school here, it was considered remote necessary, so that instead of and I don't remember exactly the cost, but like the state of Washington provides $3,000 per pupil, you know, per year, I think it was. It's more than that now, but at that time. If you're considered a remote necessary school, you get three times that amount. So Chelan would get $9,000 per pupil per year for the students that would be up here, which then made it feasible. In fact, they got in trouble in future years because they were making so much money off of the Holden school that the state sued them, and they had to pay back a huge amount of money at one point. And because the rule was that if you were a remote necessary school, that, you know, all that money had to be spent on some aspect of education for the students. And Schlein obviously wasn't paying that much, the teacher and the supplies. I mean, they weren't paying anything for, you know, the building, because we had school wherever it was convenient. We call it the hospital, now it's Agape, but that was a school for a while. You know, Koinonia was, wherever there was a room, you know, that was our school. We didn't have a separate building in a sense. But that started the Holden school then, and we had grades basically kindergarten through 12. Stehekin still only has grades kindergarten through 8th grade, and when the people up there, the families, they either homeschool for high school or they go down Lake and attend school and they board out. So Holden had came up with a school for kindergarten to 12th grade, and which still exists. And now there's actually two teachers, I think, that are here with even some paraeducators, yeah. And, you know, so it's changed completely, but in, you know, our two children that grew up here, our daughter Christy went through the 7th grade before we retired and moved to Leavenworth. So the only school she knew was, you know, the 7 grades up here. And oftentimes she was being taught by, you know, a college professor in math or literature, or because the people that were here on sabbatical, they also volunteered to help teach in the school, even though there was one teacher that was officially designated as the teacher and was being paid by Chelan. You know, the whole community literally got involved in the education system. And when the school put on a play up here at Holden for a school play, it involved the whole community. It just wasn't the school kids, it was the adults in the community, you know, it was the kids. I mean, that was one reason that we decided to move down Lake in 1983, because Christy was going to be in the 8th grade and had never experienced anything other than Holden up to that point. Our son was, I think, going into the 4th grade, I think. So we were sort of worried that maybe socially that they needed a, quote, normal experience. But they received a wonderful education up here. And the first time when they were students in Leavenworth, Cascade School District, I went to the parent teachers conference and I asked the teacher, I said, well, you know, is Christy respectful of you in the classroom? And he looked at me sort of strange and didn't know what I was talking about. And I said, well, she's never gone to school, either where she wasn't the only pupil in the class, or she dealt with primarily college-age kids up here. All of her friends were college-age, you know, I mean, on the staff. And so she sort of had a different, you know, we grew up respecting adults. You never counter adults. You don't even talk to some adults. But, you know, people that grew up here, there wasn't a distinction between youth and adult. Everybody was a part of a community. And the teacher that I asked the question, he said, well, it is a little bit unusual that when Christy asks a question, she demands that I give her an answer and won't be still until I provide that answer for her. And I said, well, that's okay, isn't it? And he said, oh, yeah, it's delightful to have somebody in the classroom that really wants to pursue an answer. So, you know, it was an excellent education, you know, here. And but that's how the Holding the School got started. And the first teacher that we had here was, it was Bev Cable, who now lives in Leavenworth. And she was the one that was actually going to volunteer, you know, to be the teacher. In fact, I think the first year we did use a volunteer teacher, and she was a volunteer teacher, and then after that they required a hired teacher. So I guess that's, we're about done with today, because otherwise they'll cut off the recording or something. If anybody has a question or anything, you know, ask it or see me, and glad to provide any information. And again, my approach to history of Holden is based on my experience, and my mind is still fairly good, so I think it's fairly accurate, but I don't guarantee anything.